It's time to meet the street with me, David Plimpton. Hello, friends, and welcome back to yet another instalment of my podcast, Meet the Street. Well, it's been a hive of activity here of recent, and I'd like to bring you up to speed on my latest pursuit via my regular feature called What I've Been Up To This Week.
What I've been up to this week.
As we all know, summer is on its way, which means one thing. That's right, flying ants. Can't stand them. They're like the ITV of the insect world. So I've taken it upon myself to begin prepping in advance of this year's imminent invasion, especially after the debacle that occurred last summer. You may not know this, but they actually managed to infiltrate our kitchen through the cooker hood and completely annihilated a Victoria sponge which Jill had gotten from Budgeons and was saving for my birthday. To make matters worse, I accidentally inhaled a cloud of the flying delinquents and nearly choked to death. Luckily for me, Jill performed the Heimlich manoeuvre which she'd learnt from a repeat of Michael Burke's 999 and saved the day. Now, most people seem to turn a blind eye to the annual barrage of these tiny flying reprobates, but I just can't ignore them. So this year, I'm building a defence system. It's very simple. Firstly, I've located their point of entry, the external feed of the cooker hood, and I've adapted it with a rather unique invention. One of these. Oh! Stronger than I thought. That's right! A cigarette lighter attached to a can of WD-40, creating my latest invention, which I call Antaway. Anyway, I'll be rigging that up this afternoon. Flying ant-free summer, here we come. No more kitchen mishaps for the Plimptons, and a fully stocked larder untainted by the likes of those flying shits. Excuse my language. Now, talking of fully stocked larders, I'd like to introduce you to the subject of this episode's interview, none other than professional speed eater John Dix. If you're a keen reader, it's highly likely you've already picked up a copy of his autobiography, Fast Food and Flak Jackets, which charts his fascinating journey from underdeveloped schoolboy to decorated military hero and on, and to his greatest achievement to date, world-class speed eating champion. In this episode, John describes his personal battle controlling his incredible appetite, talks openly about early life as a struggling teenager on the streets of the Cotswolds, and divulges what really happened to him during his time serving in Iraq and how a near brush with death led to him becoming the man he is today. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a cup of tea, and once again, let's meet the street. John Dix, professional speed eater, are you there? Can you hear me, John?
Yeah, I can hear you. How are you doing? You all right?
I am fantastic. I'm very excited to have you here. It's been a long time coming. Obviously, you are incredibly well known in your profession. And as we know, it may well all be hot dogs and fizzy drinks these days, but it's been an incredible struggle to get where you are. And your appetite hasn't always been the blessing that it is today.
No, I didn't have an appetite when I was a kid.
Right.
You wouldn't believe that, but I didn't have an appetite until the onset of puberty. One day I had a very high voice and I nibbled at things, you know, hula hoops, brie bites, little bit of pizza. Next day, honestly, testicles drop. I could eat a horse. I did eat a horse. But honestly, when you can go from nothing to eating everything, you need to really learn how to deal with that. And that's been a blessing and a curse.
You're a very slight man.
Slight of builds, but fat of mind. That's what I always say, you know, in the corporates. And my metabolism is unbelievable. You wouldn't, you know, quick as it goes in, it comes out. But growing up, you know, you acquire this monster of an appetite. You're eating things so quickly, you're not even full yet. You have to learn how to deal with it. And I had to change schools several times. You know, it's not just food. I ate chalk. I ate exercise books. I had an overhead projector. I'd eat anything. I'd look at something and it would be in my gob.
You've also paid a price personally with your family. I don't know how far you wish to speak about this, but...
Well, you know, it reached breaking point around the age of 16. I broke into a church and I ate 15 pounds of communion wafers.
Mm.
The whole body weight of Christ.
You were just learning how to use your body in the way that many teenagers would never dream of. But you were punished quite severely for for the...
For the communion wafers, yeah. It wasn't the actual act of ingesting, it was the act of regurgitating. I was peppering the church interior left, right and centre with these wafers, and of course that only made the authorities more angry. They wanted prison time. It was criminal damage.
Yeah, that really is a terrifying thing for a young person. Mm. You were far too young to face prison, but you were placed under house arrest for your own good. But even that didn't help. And something happened which drove your family to essentially disown you.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever been in house arrest, but after a period of time, I ate all of the wallpaper in my bedroom, went into the study, all of the wallpaper in that one skirting board, ate all the coving in the sitting room. You know, you could taste the Victorian craftsmanship of it. It doesn't go down well, and I was forced out of the house.
After you'd eaten, obviously, the entire interior of your family home, life really, really did start to spiral out of control. The urge to eat was unstoppable, and you found yourself out alone.
Mm.
You were on the streets, John.
Yeah.
You were homeless, and very quickly you realized it was only you that you could rely on. So in an amazing turn of events, you took to street performance.
Yeah.
To satisfy your hunger and also to make some of the very important money that would keep you going. You became something of a celebrity, John.
I'll tell you what, reasons of selfishness. Where's the tastiest place to do street performing? It's not Edinburgh. It's the Cotswolds. So if you're going to, you know, live rough, it's got to be somewhere with a limestone base.
Yeah.
So Cotswolds was for me. I'd perform to a very small group of people because in the Cotswolds, they've got the money. You don't need a big crowd. It was Clarkson, Noel Edmonds, these very elite celebrities, David Dickinson, the other guy who does Bargain Hunt as well. He's a smaller man who just, he's completely tweed. They were the ones who would give me a bit of money to eat a tyre or eat an exhaust pipe, yeah.
I think if you are going to take up drinking used diesel oil or eating an old shoe in front of some members of the public, you want those people to be, to coin the phrase, minted. You want them to give you the big money.
You know, Philip Schofield, not him, but one of his friends, you know, the magician guy who's on ITV now and then, he looks like he could be a woodland animal, a youngish guy, used to do children's television.
I think you're talking about the young chap with these sort of slightly baggy eyes, curly brown hair, and he seems to have moved away from magic and now seems to just sort of present programs such as Catchphrase.
Stephen Mulhern.
That's the one.
Stephen Mulhern. Yeah. Anyway, he gave me $1,000. Yeah, no, it did very well for myself for about 7 or 8 months.
But the people's taste towards street performance changed towards the end of the 1990s. And I think one of the biggest movements in the street performance scene in the 90s was, of course, the advent of the Peruvian Pampipus,
yeah.
The country went insane to groups of these Peruvians playing cover versions of songs by
Westlife, Pet Shop Boys. Three Lions 98 version, though.
Yes,
honestly, I can hear it ringing my ears now,
and the music is
beautiful.
But something people don't realize, they are incredibly well organized criminals. According to the Daily Mail, they've shifted over 85% of the cocaine found in this country.
Yeah, through the pipes, yeah.
Yeah, through the pipes. And this is something you witnessed firsthand because they threatened to kill you unless you gave them 50% of your earnings.
I had to, really. And the earnings wouldn't have been that much anyway because Clarkson, they weren't interested in eating anymore. That had gone because nobody wanted to eat anymore. So that was me gone overnight, just like puberty, you know. Testicles drop in act one. This is act two. Earnings drop. And that's a bit like testicles, you know.
Yeah. Your life had taken so many twists and turns, going from a young boy who's had no appetite at all to...
Yeah. Testicles, yeah.
And then gaining an incredible appetite.
Yeah.
Being thrown out of your home for eating the wallpaper and ending up on the streets performing like a circus clown for people such as Jeremy Clarkson or the one with baggy eyes from that television program. It was an incredibly tumultuous time, but outside of your life, the country itself was in a state. Let's just say the United Kingdom in 2003 was in chaos. That summer, the temperatures reached record highs of 38 degrees. People couldn't take it. Millions were taking to the streets to protest at the Iraq war. And of course, Maurice Gibb of the Bee Gees had just passed away after undergoing surgery for an intestinal blockage. The people were on tenterhooks. But amidst all this chaos, where many would fail, you saw a fantastic opportunity, John.
In a time of national crisis, there's two industries that prosper. And, you know, it's the fact of life. I'm talking Wetherspoons and I'm talking the army.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, how do I combine the two? I thought, oh, yeah, you join the army, but you get a job in the kitchen. So I signed up, and of course, 2003, every single person in the armed forces got straight to Iraq. And luckily enough, day one of training, they say, what do you want to do? Do you want to shoot someone or do you want to cook something? And I said, to be fair, I'd like to shoot someone, but hey, you know what? Give me a job in the kitchens. If I'm good enough at that, then maybe I could graduate up to killing people.
Yeah.
And it was hot. It was, you know, think about 38 degrees in the United Kingdom. It was 38 degrees at night in Iraq.
Unbelievable.
But that's a good thing, because that hot weather helps suppress your cravings for food. You don't eat as much if you're hot.
I can relate to this. I know a lot of your life story, John, is very hard to fathom. But Jill and I went to the Isle of Wight in 2009, and it was an incredibly warm weekend. We were there. And on the Saturday, all we had was a quiche.
Yeah.
Yeah. But back to the story. There you are in Iraq, peeling these potatoes. You manage to control your cravings incredibly well. And for once in your life, you're accepted by your army mates. And I think this sense of camaraderie is something that really helped you through. It must have been the first time in your life you'd ever been accepted. And that must have been a wonderful feeling. But something went terribly wrong.
Yeah, I was angry. It was raw anger. I looked at the notice board. Jim Davidson dates cancelled. He'd announced he was fully committed to the party Veritas. Do you remember Veritas? It was a precursor to UKIP, I believe. Yeah. And do you know who they were going to get in to replace him?
Tell us.
Jethro.
You cannot take a West Country comedian into a war zone. You cannot do that.
They don't really know who Jethro is. Everyone knows who Jim Davidson is because everyone's swapping their Big Break videos.
Exactly.
Everyone's swapping around their behind-the-scenes Big Break annuals. Everyone's talking about Jim Davidson this, Jim Davidson's that. When's Jim Davidson back out? Oh, looking at that notice board, Jim Davidson wasn't coming for 6 months. So I was angry and I ate 28 kilos of raw potatoes and I ate a gun. All right, I had an L115A3, a sniper rifle full of .338 Lapua Magnums, which I believe are the bullets. I'm not a ballistics expert. I don't know if you pronounce the decimal point before the 338. I don't care. I was there to peel potatoes and make burgers, but, you know, I ate a gun. And the only reason I know for sure what type of gun it was, because that was on the documents released at the time of my court-martial.
And this is the point in your life where it really could have gone to hell in a handcart, because you'd gone from being one of the buddy boys to being locked up in a cell and facing a court-martial for eating, how many was it, 28 kilos of raw potatoes?
Yeah, and a gun. Don't forget the gun.
And a gun.
Don't forget the gun. And if anything, they were more angry about the gun. It's very, very serious if you eat a gun. They said, look, mate, you need to regurgitate that thing quickly, but vomit those bullets out, then someone's going to get killed.
It's very different to regurgitating a bag of Watsits.
Yeah.
And you must have felt so incredibly alone at this point. Mm. How on earth did you think this would work out for you?
From what I could understand, they were going to lock me up and throw away the key. I wrote to Jim Davidson and said, look, mate, I'm in trouble here. Nothing, you know, and if anything, I blame him the most for this. Jim Davidson ruined my army career.
He's betrayed you and he's betrayed the British forces, and it's disgusting. And you end up in a position where you're in a living hell at this point. But things changed, John, dramatically. Overnight, you're alone in this cell and a surprise attack occurred.
Well, the camp was overwhelmed. That much is clear. And none other was it overwhelmed by than Uday and Qusay Hussein. Remember Saddam Hussein? Yeah, his sons.
These were brutal men.
These were brutal men. People say, oh, these guys, you know, they just sent other people out to do their dirty work for them. But these guys were at the forefront of this mission, right?
Yeah.
And they broke into HQ. And as the alarms were going off, a lance corporal, he came in and he said, look, mate, I know that you're in prison, but mm-hmm. you need to come out right now because we're being overwhelmed. The enemy are here. It's mm-hmm. none other than Uday and Qusay Hussein and they're, you know, about 1,000 other men. Yeah. They've broken into headquarters. So I said, right, okay, I'll come out, but, you know, give me a second to brush my teeth and, you know, get my clothes on.
Get changed, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm running around not knowing what to do because everyone's going crazy. This is a perfect time to escape, right?
Yeah.
But I found myself in a little shed, which usually has gardening equipment for, like, allotments, right? Because they've got a few allotments in the camp.
The army often prepare their own fruit and veg when
yeah,
when
it's easier than getting it in. And what did I see in there? I saw the reason that Uday and Qusay wanted to get into the camp in the first place. And that is a 900-page top secret plan by Her Majesty's government and the armed forces. It had lists of all of where all the troops were, what the names of the troops were, date of births, telephone numbers, you know, dietary requirements, all of that in this 900-page. And I remember it because it had, you know, you look through it and last page, it says the 900 at the bottom in Latin, in Roman numerals. So I ate it. I ate the top secret plan to stop Uday and Qusay getting their mitts on it. I think anyone would have done the same. But the fact is, because I'm skilled at this, I could eat it in, what, 900 pages. We're talking, God, it was a flash. But realistically, it took about 3 minutes and 50 seconds. And they needed that, you know, to get the phone numbers and all of that and the dietary requirements of all the army.
According to your book, which goes into much further depth over this story, and the moment you ate that document, they just stopped because you had completely scuppered their plans. They turned around and just went home with their tails in between their legs.
It was so quick, but if someone eats something, you can't do anything about it. And luckily enough, they didn't have the intel, these lads, because if they'd have just forced me at gunpoint to regurgitate it straight away, then I would have regurgitated every page as it was and it would have been completely legible. But that's a little bit of mind games on my part, you know, and luck that they didn't ask that. Instead of, you know, they just gave up.
This story just goes in and out and up and down. There are knife-edge turns constantly here. You've gone from this young boy with an underdeveloped penis to someone whose testicles have dropped and you've become a man who's gained an incredible appetite, being unable to control yourself, eating the wallpaper from your family's home, being thrown out onto the streets, ending up performing like a seal or a monkey for people such as Jeremy Clarkson and all the man with baggy eyes, Stephen Mulhan, being completely down on your luck, joining the army, eating a gun, almost being court-martialed, and then eating some top secret plans that stopped Uday and Qusay Hussein from winning the war in Iraq. Mm. It's amazing. You must have been treated like a hero, John.
You win a war and everyone wants to be with you. You know, everyone wants to hear your story, even more so than, you know, Jim Davidson when he goes up on stage. People want to hear what you're saying.
Indeed.
Well, I was treated, you know, firstly, sorry. Sorry we arrested you for eating a gun. Had a wee. Like, they let me go to the toilets, you know, fairly soon after that. Full honourable discharge. And on top of that, you know, flown home, private jet, slap up meal, Tony Blair, Prince Charles, cast of EastEnders, Dennis Rickman, Mickey Miller, do you remember him? Who's played by Joe Swash?
Yes.
Had a meal with them, those four. And they even talked about me on the end of London Tonight, you know, the end segment where it's like, oh, bit of light relief before the weather. Literally 5 minutes about how I stopped a war.
That meal you had looked fantastic.
4 family-sized shepherd's pies, 16 pork sausages, 3 kilos of jacket potatoes, 1 kilo special fried rice with mushrooms, a mushroom omelette, 3 large servings of spaghetti bolognese, 1 full English, 1 chicken chow mein, 3 family-sized bottles of Cherryade, a family-sized trifle from Marks & Spencer's finest range, and 6 choc ices. And do you know what, right? At the end of the meal, I get a text. It's Gillian Tailforth, who was also in EastEnders. She says, I couldn't make it to the meal tonight, but I love your work. I've loved what you've done. And, you know, I text her back. And then she did text me later saying, actually, sorry, she thought this was Julian Dix, the former West Ham footballer, not me, John Dix. And
right.
Sorry, she got her wires crossed and Joe Swasher played a little prank on her. But still, Gillian Tailforth, unbelievable, getting a text off her. She's basically like the queen of EastEnders.
Young men up and down the country dream on a daily basis of having a large meal and then receiving a text message from Gillian Tailforth. This really must have been a dream come true for you and a fantastic time. You were loved. And the term hero really doesn't even do justice when it comes to describing what you achieved there, John. But aside from the adoration that you received from the media and the public alike, you still really had nothing left but the old kit bag from the army and some meager savings. Yeah. Essentially, once the furore had died down, you found yourself once again hungry and out of work. But fate stepped in.
Yeah, fate stepped in. I received a phone call from you'll know sports agent Eric Cole. That took me, you know, by surprise. You know, he was heavily interested in breaking some UK talent into the speed eating scene. And was I interested in giving speed eating a go? I'd eaten things quickly. I'd eaten things for money. But you know what I hadn't done until this point? I hadn't eaten competitively. You know, and I didn't even realize it was a thing. It's massive in America. It's massive in Australia. I tell you this, I'll never forget it. He said, 6 months, you'll be in Florida. You'll be in Florida eating with the best of them.
And that was where the story really comes full circle, because from that phone call, you've gone on to become the man you are today.
Yeah.
And what a fantastic story, John. I still sometimes have to pinch myself whenever I listen to your audiobook, because it's amazing, you know, and you've gone from living on the streets, from being this young boy with a severely underdeveloped penis that eventually developed and it gave you an incredible appetite that then led to you eating the wallpaper from your parents' house, being thrown out on the streets, having to drink diesel oil in front of Jeremy Clarkson to make money, going on to join the army, nearly being court-martialed for eating a gun, eating some secret plans to stop Hussein Qudai Hussein from winning the Iraq conflict, to a television star and to a world speed eating champion. Now you live a very different life. You live a very lavish lifestyle and you have a very comfortable home life. But do you remember the first thing you decided to treat yourself after winning your first speed eating competition? I often wonder what people do when they first receive large amounts of money.
First thing I did, I bought more wallpaper for my parents' house. And I thought to myself, that would be a nice touch. So I got some Laura Ashley, a nice pattern, about 4 or 5 meters of it, and I just FedExed it over. So
you had not actually spoken to your family in several years. What was the reaction when they received that Laura Ashley wallpaper?
Unfortunately, they'd moved since. So the person who did receive it, she was called Betty, and she actually really loves Laura Ashley, and she papered up her downstairs bathroom, and her son-in-law was staying there for a while because he was out of work, so she papered his room, and no, she was delighted with it. But no, it didn't have the desired effects on my part, patching up my relationship with my parents, if that's what you're asking. But I did make a friend in Betty, and no, she writes to me often, very much like Arnold Schwarzenegger and his landlady in London. They were still friends, you know, when he became famous.
But still no sign of reconnecting with the family.
No. I mean, okay. They find my success acutely embarrassing.
Outside of your incredibly busy schedule, how do you manage to relax? I recently read an interview in Woman's Own magazine that said you're a keen guitarist.
Yeah, I've been playing acoustic for about 15 years. I'm going to crowdfund myself an album. Been playing a lot on the road. It's the one instrument I wouldn't eat. I can only play one song. It's a song I've composed. It's a song I know and love. It's a song that kind of, well, it sums me up. And it speaks to my youth, and it reminds me of my parents, and it's a love song to my mum.
Do you think it would be possible, I could twist your arm, that you could perhaps play this piece of music that's taken you on this journey through life?
Yeah, this is my one big chance to get through to her. So yeah, I'd be absolutely delighted. If you're listening, mum, this one's for you. Thank you.
Well, John, that's certainly a very beautiful piece of music. Obviously, a reworking there of the theme tune from the 1984 the film.
Sorry, what? No.
The melody there is clearly the melody from the film Terminator. It's incredibly well done, John. I think you've done a wonderful job, and you've made it sound so very different, and you've obviously put your own touch on there, which I think is fantastic.
Well, that's taken me aback, but I've composed that. And
well, that is, you do know that's the music from Terminator.
No, it's not.
The theme tune from the film Terminator is what you've just played.
I'm not sure if you've seen Terminator, but I don't think there's an acoustic in there, and I haven't seen it. And
it's not, so much. It's there's not an acoustic guitar in the film Terminator,
right.
But the music itself, what you've just played there, that was the theme tune. We'll move on, John. We'll move on.
I think we're going to have to agree to disagree, and I think on the album, I'm going to have to. I've already printed the cover. And it's me looking at a picture of my mum, and it's black and white, and yeah. I'm going off to war, you know, like a Second World War thing, but yeah. Iraq, and there's a picture of Iraq in the background,
yeah.
And I've got a knife and fork. I've just tried to get everything in there for the album cover. I've already printed that. Well, at least it's gone. The JPEG's gone off to the printers. So
yeah, if you know a good graphic designer, it may be worth getting in contact with them to try and change that album cover to at least have a stainless steel robot with bright red eyes on the front. But that's up to you, John, and that's you live your life how you want to. Anyway, John, I must thank you so much for taking part in today's interview. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. You're a gentleman, and I'd just like to say before you leave, if anyone does wish to reach out to you, they can follow you via your Twitter account, which is at Fast Food Dicks.
Yeah.
Your website is www.roomforabitmore.com.
Yeah. Not .org. .org is it's a porno. Okay.
Right.
So yeah. It's a porno, and it's from, you know, Lebanon or somewhere. It's weird, and it's just .com, all right? .com.
Yeah, .com, yeah. And also your book, John Dix, Fast Food and Flak Jackets.
Fast Food and Flak Jackets, yeah. Fast Food and Flak Jackets. Mm-hmm. FFAFJ. It's this alliteration, of course. And that's what I say to the, you know, when I'm doing the book signings.
That's right. And also, of course, with the book signings, you will be making a series of appearances throughout the UK later this summer on your Big Eats tour, which yep. I believe the information will be released. Now, this would be through your website, which is www.roomforabitmore.com, but it's not through your Twitter, which is at Fast Food Dix, or is it through your Twitter at Fast Food Dix, as well as your website, www.roomforabitmore.com?
I don't really go on Twitter. I'm only on there because I thought that if I take that handle, I don't want to keep going back to porn, but I thought someone might, you know, try and buy that off me, one of the porn barons, Fast Food Dix. It might be like a, you know, one of those cooking with your knob things. And to be fair, no one's bought it. No one's even offered. So, no, I've got that Twitter handle, but I'm not really a Twitter person.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll say let's just get this right then. The Big Eats tour will be announced via your website, which is www.roomforabitmore.com.
Not .org,
because that's sex.
Yeah, that's sex. And it's honestly, I've been there a couple of times looking at it.
Yeah.
And honestly, I've tried to buy it off them, you know, but they want too much for it. And it's, just don't go on that website is what I'm saying to you.
Yeah. Do not go there. Disgusting.
Yeah.
Anyway, John, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. And I hope to catch up with you soon and to perhaps share a hot meal with you. So
wouldn't that be nice?
That was a nice way of ending, I think.
Yeah.
Is there any other way you would like to end?
I was just going to say I'd eat it really quickly.
Yeah.
But no, I wouldn't though, because again, I wouldn't want to patronize you.
Although, I mean, for the sake of the edit, we could redo the end and I could say, I would like to join you for a hot meal, and you could then say, I'll eat it really quickly, and then we could laugh, and it sounds quite natural.
Yeah.
And
Okay. All right, you go for it. Yep. Okay.
So, John, thank you very much for taking part in the interview. It's been great to speak to you over the airwaves, and hopefully soon I can meet up with you face to face, and we can enjoy a hot meal together.
I'll eat it very quickly, though.
It's funny because he eats.
Yeah. No, I'm not very good at the jokes. I'm not very good at the jokes.
Yeah, okay. I'll just press stop now. Okay. Goodbye. If you've enjoyed this episode of Meet the Street, remember to like and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast provider. Follow me on Twitter at PlimptonDavid. And join my Facebook page at Meet the Street One. And if you're really feeling generous, you can donate a small fee via ko-fi.com/Meet the Street. Every penny helps. Until next time, goodbye. Jill, I've done it. You can use the spare room for the washing now.